Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Theodora Gaitis, and I'm joined this morning by my colleagues, Judge Brockfold and Judge Larson. We are now ready to proceed with the fourth case on our calendar this November 17th, 2022, Morex Properties LLC versus Soro and Bergstrom PLLC, A220704. And I see both counsel on the screen this morning. Welcome and good morning to you. We will be counting down the time for your arguments today using a clock that is visible on the screen. Could you please nod your head if you're able to see that clock? Okay. All right, it looks like you can both see it. Great. Just a few more words to both of you before we turn things over to you. We are appearing via the Zoom platform this morning to make sure that the argument goes smoothly. I just ask that when you're not speaking, you please mute yourself. We're making a recording of this argument that will be available on our website. It's just an audio recording. And so to assist us with the quality of that recording, I do ask you to stay muted when not speaking. I'd also ask you to please introduce yourself and the party you're representing before you begin your argument. Now, as to time, appellant will have 15 minutes to present and respondent will also have 15 minutes. Appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal. That ends my remarks. Both counsel are, as I noted here, ready to go. We'll hand things over to counsel for the appellant now. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Paul, P-A-U-L, that's my last name. I've got two first names. I represent Morex Properties in this appeal. Morex Properties is the appellant. The background facts of this case are straightforward, and I would ask the court to take judicial notice of the related file stemming from a construction dispute and a breach of contract allegations between Morex Properties, The Right Group, Allen Max Construction, and Allen Max, another Allen Max entity. That lawsuit was commenced back in 2016. It was tried to a jury in 2018, so it's very old. I appealed, as your honors know, I appealed the verdict against Morex Properties for $21,000. And while that appeal was pending, $21,000 was levied from Morex Properties' bank account. As you all know, the verdict against Morex Properties was then reversed, the matter remanded for further proceedings in the district court before the Honorable Teresa Neal. Many months went by and there was a motion hearing on the remand. And at the motion hearing, the attorney for Allen Max Construction urged the court to fashion a remedy that didn't require Allen Max or anyone else to pay restitution that Morex Properties was entitled to. And the court indicated on the record in that hearing that she was indeed going to fashion an equitable remedy and not require Allen Max or Soro and Bergstrom or anybody related to who got the money to have to pay it back. Well, that ultimately turned out not to be true. Judge Neo issued a very simple order. It's reflected and quoted in my memorandum. And the summary of that order is this: this court vacates the judgment against Morex Properties LLC and reverses the jury's award of $21,067.79. No other changes are required by the court's remand, and the judgment in favor of the plaintiff remains. Now, as is probably fairly crystal clear from my submissions, my chances of obtaining restitution if Judge Neal presided over a restitution claim were zero. There was no way in the world that Judge Neal was ever going to allow Morex Properties its undeniable right to restitution. And
no, so, counsel, but just to be clear, you've never formally requested restitution in that file.
Never, not once. There is not one word anywhere in that file.
You would need to request that in that file for Judge Neo to make a decision about restitution.
That is, you're spot on, Judge. And I never said that I was going to seek restitution. I never asked for restitution. When I pointed that out to Judge Neo time and time again, she said, well, maybe you, she implied, and you can read the record on your own. She implied, well, you brought an oral motion. And it is so extremely frustrating because I never brought an oral motion. Anything from the beginning, virtually from the beginning of the case to date, anything I've ever asked for on behalf of Morex Properties had been denied by Judge Neo. Indeed, on the morning of the trial, pursuant to a motion in limine, and I lost this at the Court of Appeals, all of my claims, my counterclaims by Morex Properties were dismissed pursuant to a motion in limine that was granted in its entirety by Judge Neo. And so all I was left with was defending Morex Properties in the right group. But that was a long answer, Judge. I apologize. I never asked for restitution. And everybody acknowledges, including Mr. Bradford on behalf of Sorrow and Bergstrom, that I never sought restitution. Indeed, in a
quote— But you did seek post-trial discovery.
Yes. And let me explain that, Judge. Kind of and kind of not. I sent informal interrogatories and requests for production of documents to Sorrow and Bergstrom. I knew they weren't going to answer them. And indeed, Sorrow and Bergstrom then said, Mr. Paul, the discovery requests that you sent are improper. They weren't served correctly. They weren't served in accordance with the rules of civil procedure. And we're not answering them, you know, surprise, surprise. And the new attorney, Anthony Smith from Smith, Jaden, and whatever the, they became the new attorneys of record for Allen Max Construction. And then after I served, and I didn't serve them correctly, and I admitted, okay, it doesn't matter, pretend they don't exist, because they didn't answer them anyway, and I knew they wouldn't. And then because Sorrow and Bergstrom and Allen Max Construction had such great luck with the rulings by Judge Neo, they brought the unique, and I'd never heard of one, a preemptive motion for a protective order saying, Bill Paul, paraphrase, you can't do
where,
any discovery.
Where the district court said you haven't requested restitution in this file yet, correct?
Say that one more time, Judge, please.
I mean, wasn't part of the basis of the district court's order that you hadn't yet requested restitution and gotten judgment for restitution, and so you weren't entitled to the discovery?
No, I respectfully disagree. Smith Jaden submitted a proposed order which was signed word for word, the protective order. And there was no explanation given as to why I wasn't entitled to discovery. The ostensible reason was that I had not docketed a judgment in favor of Morex Properties and against Allen Max. And without the docketing of a judgment, you can't engage in post-judgment discovery, which there's a case right smack on point that's it's a non-published opinion that says you can engage in discovery even if you don't docket the judgment, because of course there's a post-judgment rule and statute, and so that was the reason given. Since then, Judge, I have docketed a judgment, and the Court of Appeals recently issued an order denying my petition for a writ of mandamus on that protective order. As you probably know, I sought entry of judgment so I could appeal that. It is now rendered moot because Mr. Jaden and I have agreed and stipulated to the lifting of that protective order. That stipulation was filed sometime around October 15th or something, and Judge Neal still has not signed the order stipulating to the lifting of the protective order. I don't know why. I've inquired.
So, counsel, your time is running down, and I do have some questions with regard to your claims in this file.
Okay.
So my first question for you is you are arguing that it was a legal error for this case to have been directly assigned to Judge Neo in this second action. Is it your contention that there's a legal requirement that you get a judge by random assignment? And if so, what is your legal support for that argument?
I don't have any. I have always thought, Judge, that cases are randomly assigned. I have been told, and I've looked for a rule, but I have been told that they're computerized and randomly assigned, and that minimizes or prevents judge shopping. And in this case, so I don't have any legal support. I have just always been told that cases are randomly assigned, as I thought they should be. And otherwise, you'd have a situation, Judge, wherein Judge Sally Tarnowski, I'm making it up, she has a lot of experience with a particular area of the law. Again, I'm making it up. Oh, since she has the most experience in private practice about this area of the law, I think that she would have the best fund of knowledge to handle this particular legal dispute. So the scheduling judge assigns it to Judge Tarnowski. That's a hypothetical. None of that happened. And I just didn't think that that's the way things are supposed to occur. But let us assume that Judge Hilden had the right and power to do that, which I submit he shouldn't. Then when it's assigned to Judge Neo and I'm able to establish it's a new proceeding, a brand new proceeding.
Okay, so I would like to move to your notice of removal under Rule 63.03. Okay. And my question for you is, hasn't our court already decided the not the bias portion of this claim, but the peremptory removal question? Didn't we just already decide that issue in a special term order?
And I'm in a conundrum here. I'm faced with a Court of Appeals panel and asking the Court of Appeals panel to find that whoever in that special term gave deference to the false statements to correct that error. Because here's what I figure happened. The entity, the judge or clerks or whomever, they read an order from Judge Neo saying, I've ruled on this. Mr. Paul brought a motion. Mr. Paul never made mention that he had sought restitution in the underlying case. When I read the denial of my writ of mandamus, I thought, oh no, didn't somebody, I know Judge Neo hasn't read the underlying record from 2016.
I do believe though, counsel, that there's a Supreme Court case from 1984 that says once the writ of prohibition, when a writ of prohibition on a notice of removal has been decided, that you don't then get to bring that in another subsequent appeal.
I didn't know that. So the error will be compounded because it ought to be clear to everyone in the world that Judge Neo did not rule on the restitution case in the underlying action, and this is a new proceeding. And if that was my fear, that Morix Properties would somehow be denied its undeniable right to the entitlement to restitution, and by virtue of Judge Neo making a blatantly false statement that then is given deference by a Court of Appeals panel or person or clerk, and that would defeat my ability to remove her, which I respectfully submit is just plain wrong. But if that's the way the world works, then I'm stuck with it. And then my fallback position, judges, is that if I fail on the assignment being allowed. And because the Court of Appeals read something that Judge Neal stated something as being a fact when it's not true, and I lose the writ of mandamus because no one has read the 2016 record, then my third fallback position is Judge Neal refusing to recuse herself for absolute obvious bias. As I say in my affidavit, I predicted it. Judge Neal, if you do not remove yourself, you are going to grant the Rule 12 motion to dismiss, and you are going to sanction Morex Properties and me a whole bunch of money for a very legitimate restitution lawsuit. And ta-da, what does she do? She grants the motion, and after that, or on the same day, issues the order denying my motion to recuse, so I don't have time to go to the chief judge to review that because she has dismissed the lawsuit and imposed the sanctions, and on that same day denies my
motion. Counsel, you have less than a minute left, and I do have one question for you on sanctions, and that is, am I correct that you did not respond to the motion for sanctions?
I did not respond to the motion for sanctions because, and the reason being—
And if so, if that's true, are your arguments before our court on this being on the arguments that you made being non-frivolous arguments, are those waived or forfeited on appeal?
Judge Neal permitted me to make an argument in response to the Rule 12 motion to dismiss. And then she said, I couldn't argue on the sanctions, but then I would submit to you, there were no safe harbor notices. None of the prerequisites to the imposition of sanctions was followed by Sorrow and Bergstrom. No motion was served beforehand. So if we're talking about matters of law, I would submit, Judge, as a matter of law, Sorrow and Bergstrom is not entitled to sanctions because they didn't follow the 549.21, which requires notice, et cetera, and it's strictly complied with. It requires strict compliance and no waiver, and that's all. So my time is up. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Next, we will hear from counsel for respondent. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Gaetis, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the respondent, Sorrow and Bergstrom. This court should affirm in all respects. And I'd like to start out my argument by answering a couple of the questions that Judge Larson asked as it relates to the random assignment, which is the first issue that was raised in my friend's brief. And as you just heard, there is no standard that the appellant has articulated that governs the assignment of cases in Duluth from which error can be presumed. There's no standard. There's no statute that's been referred to the court. And as we pointed out, error is not presumed on appeal. That is enough to affirm. But more than that, and I regret that this didn't receive the attention it deserved in the briefing, there's an order in the addendum that assigns this case to the expedited litigation track. There are special rules that relate to cases in the ELT. Chief Justice Gilday issued an order back in 2013 that governs proceedings in an ELT. And if you review that order, you will see that there one of the core principles of the ELT is the need for flexibility in case assignments. And essentially there's an initial case management conference, which Judge Heilden presided over here. And what the rules essentially say is after that, there is complete flexibility in case assignment to ensure the efficient prosecution of cases in the ELT. It talks about, you may even need teams of judges approached. They call it a pool of judges. And so there's complete discretion when it comes to assignment of cases within the ELT. Number two, it's undeniable on this record that Morex Properties started this second lawsuit against Sorrow and Bergstrom to obtain the very fact discovery that Judge Neal precluded through a protective order in the first action. And as we pointed out in our brief, you don't have to take our word for that. It is expressed in Mr. Paul's emails to the law firm where he says, if you don't answer this discovery, I'm going to start a second lawsuit against you and I'm going to get the discovery in that case. Mr. Paul put that in an affidavit on addendum page 57 in paragraphs 13 and 14 that he's starting this lawsuit to get the information that Sauerland Bergstrom would not provide in the first lawsuit. And he even told Judge Neo on the record, the court has the transcript on October 18, 2021 at page 14, that he was starting this second lawsuit because he didn't like the protective order in the first case. One of the very first certifications that an attorney has to make under Rule 11 is that they're not starting the case for an improper purpose. Vexatious litigation is prohibited. And that's exactly what this was. And when the case came before Judge Neo on the motion to quash the notice of removal, she had all of those statements by Mr. Paul in front of her. And in her order on addendum pages 33 and 34, she specifically recites that she issued a protective order on discovery, that Mr. Paul threatened to bring a second lawsuit if Sauerland Bergstrom did not respond to that discovery. And that's exactly what he did. And why is that important? Because if you look at the decisions in Omaha Financial and some of the other cases that address Rule 63.03, if it's clear to the court that a second lawsuit is merely a continuation of the initial proceedings, the court does not have to honor a notice of removal. And that's exactly what happened here. On top
of counsel, hasn't our court already decided the preemptory?
Yes.
And, do you disagree with?
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, when I read our special term order, it does seem that our special term panel reached the merits of the preemptory removal. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't disagree with that at all. And I think you're right that there is a remedy if Mr. Paul or his client disagrees with that special term order, and it would have been to take an appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court, which of course they didn't do. So on top of that, though, I think they're wrong just on the merits of Rule 63.03 if the court were to even reach that issue here. Let me address bias for just a second. Mr. Paul says that it's clear on this record that Judge Neo is objectively biased against his client. And that is just wrong. If you look at the decisions that Judge Neo issued, on remand, the court entertained oral argument on what the court should do with respect to restitution. At that argument, my client argued that restitution should not be available to Morex Properties, and that if it were available, they should get that remedy from the co-defendant, the Wright Group. Judge Neo decided that issue against us. In other words, she said she strongly considered whether to preclude restitution, and the court said, I'm not going to do that. That is not evidence of bias. That's a decision that went against us. When it came to Rule 11 sanctions, the law firm Sauerland Bergstrom requested about $30,000 in attorney's fees for having to defend the second lawsuit. She took an objective look at those fees and cut them in half. That is a sign of a judge who is following the facts and the law, not who is biased in any regard. The argument on bias is, and you just heard Mr. Paul repeat it, I could predict what the judge was going to do with the Rule 12 motion for judgment on the pleadings, and I could predict what the judge was going to do on sanctions. There's a reason for that. The claim was invalid as a matter of law. Anyone could have predicted what any district court judge was going to do with that because the claim had no merit out of the box.
No, counsel, I do have a question about that, though, because I understand that the restatement is pretty clear about this and that there are other jurisdictions, but I don't think that at the time that appellant brought this claim that there was a Minnesota case on point that had adopted specifically, I mean, I don't think our court or the Minnesota Supreme Court had adopted that portion of the restatement. Is that incorrect?
It is, Your Honor, with respect. If you look at Matheson versus Clearwater County, which is this court's decision in 1987, the court actually cites the same section of the restatement in that case.
But does that, when we, I mean, so if our court cites to a section of the restatement, does that, is it your position that we then adopt, that we then are endorsing all of the comments? Because my understanding is your argument is coming from one of the comments to that section in the restitution restatement.
From comment H. And illustration 20, I believe it is.
And so, I mean, do you disagree that it would be, I mean, just based on the case law in Minnesota right now, that it would be, you know, an unreasonable stretch for appellant to be saying, I don't think that Minnesota courts should adopt a comment in the restatement that Minnesota has not yet adopted.
So, Your Honor, the problem with that is they didn't respond to the motion to dismiss, right? So I have no idea whether they had a good faith argument for the expansion of Minnesota law or not, because they never made it. And that's the point here. So we came forward with case law and the restatement, which was cited in the Minnesota Court of Appeals decision in 1987, that said, these standards are very clear. They responded with nothing. And so the question is, did the district court on that record abuse its discretion in sanctioning appellant? And by the way, I mean, the court gave appellant every opportunity to come forward with another argument in response to the motion for dismiss, notwithstanding that they didn't respond on the merits at all. The court said, give me a case anywhere that supports your position. Pardon me, my lights just turned off. Give me a case anywhere that supports your position. And counsel's representation was, oh, there's a plethora of decisions, but none were actually cited. And if you look at the reply brief, which is where now they try to backfill, there's two cases cited. One is Matheson, which I think supports actually our position, because their restitution was ordered against a party to the case. The county was actually a party to that case, had received funds directly from the party seeking restitution. That's not what we have here. And number two, they cite now a New Jersey case, which was never cited to the district court, from 1950. And in that case, there was an order directing a party to pay money to the lawyers as part of the taxable costs in the case. Here, there's no order that required appellant to make any payment to Sauer and Bergstrom. And I have looked long and hard, Judge. I cannot find a case anywhere that orders restitution on facts similar to what we have here. The only cases that order restitution involve cases where there are contingent fee agreements, because the lawyer's compensation is contingent on the outcome of the case. I think there's the Eighth Circuit decision that we cited that recites some of those cases. So even today, Mr. Paul can't cite this court to anything, any argument for a good faith extension of Minnesota law, and he doesn't do it in his brief.
Can you remind me, counsel, what bases that you brought before the district court for Rule 11 sanctions? Like, which were the Rule 11 bases that you relied on for saying that your client was entitled to sanctions?
Yeah, as I recall, the bases were that the lawsuit was brought for an improper purpose and without a basis in fact or law. I think that was recited in the notice of motion. I'm paraphrasing it, Your Honor, but that's what I recall. If you look at, I think there was a
representative. So would it be your position then? Understanding that appellant didn't respond, and so perhaps a lot of, you know, these arguments were not actually in front of the district court, but even if this was sort of asking for a reasonable extension, would it still be your argument that this lawsuit was brought for an improper purpose and that the Rule 11 sanctions were appropriate? If we disagreed with you that this wasn't asking for a reasonable extension of the law.
Yes. And so the short answer is yes. And I think as support for that, I would cite you to Judge Neo's order that quashed the notice of removal on pages 33 and 34 of the addendum. And that's where she said, look, I issued a protective order that said you cannot get discovery from Sauer and Bergstrom. And then 2 days later, they start this new lawsuit against Sauer and Bergstrom. And Mr. Paul was very clear that the reason he was bringing the new lawsuit was to get the very discovery that Judge Neo said he can't have. That is an improper purpose. I think Judge Neo called it an end around or something to that effect. And it's exactly right. That's what this is. We shouldn't have to fend off improper discovery requests in one action and then have to defend a lawsuit that is brought to get those very same documents. That is sort of the sine qua non of an improper purpose for bringing a lawsuit. I want to end by just saying one thing, and I've scoured this record, and I think your first question, Judge Larson, was to Mr. Paul was, have you ever even gone after Alan Max for restitution? And the answer is no. We are now 3 years post remand, and they have not filed a claim and served Alan Max with any pleading claiming restitution. All of this,
which you would agree he could have done in the original file.
He could do it two ways. He could do it in the original case file, and there's case law support for that. Or if he had just sued Alan Max in a separate lawsuit and said, I'm entitled to restitution for $21,000, all of this could have been avoided. There would have been no improper purpose by joining the law firm. And he would have, I think, a legitimate claim for restitution against the only party from whom he could conceivably get it. And that's Alan Max. All of this would have been avoided. Yet we're sitting here today, 3 years later, talking about the propriety of a lawsuit against the law firm that defended Alan Max. He never even served Alan Max. And I have no idea from this record, he's got self-help available, which is to just sue Alan Max. And instead, we've been wasting all of this time on a completely ancillary lawsuit that was brought for an improper purpose. So for all of those reasons, we're asking this court to affirm, end the case against Søren Bergstrom. And if Mr. Paul has some remedy that he wants to seek against Alan Max in a separate lawsuit or in the original lawsuit, he can go ahead and do that.
Thank you for your argument. So Mr. Paul, we'll get the clock up here. And I guess I would like to begin your rebuttal with a question, and that is, why didn't you seek restitution in the underlying matter?
Simple as this, Judge. Had I gone to Judge Neo, who was presiding in the underlying action, she would have denied my claim for restitution, period. That I hope is crystal clear.
Because in your judgment, she was biased or what?
Yes, she, indeed, she was so biased that when I brought this new restitution lawsuit, which I am entitled to do on behalf of Morex Properties, indeed, Your Honor, I would submit that it would have been legal malpractice for me to bring a motion of any sort or any nature in front of Judge Neo on behalf of Morex Properties, because it would have been denied. The second reason that I commenced a separate lawsuit, in addition to, and I'm going to admit this, to get a new impartial judge, is I needed to have different parties that the court in the underlying action did not have any jurisdiction over, namely Sorrow and Bergstrom in the Warner Law Office. And so I had to commence a separate lawsuit. Thirdly, the reason I brought a separate lawsuit is because I believe that Sorrow and Bergstrom received the $21,000. Now, I used to think that I was going to find that out. I'm a little less optimistic today, but time will tell. But had I brought, if a judge who writes in orders refusing to honor a timely notice to remove something that did not happen, that I brought a motion in an underlying case and she had denied my claim for restitution, if that is not proof, objective proof of biasness, then I would respectfully submit there can be no proof. She represented to the Court of Appeals in orders, I mean, not they weren't directed to the Court of Appeals, but that this issue was litigated, decided, and Mr. Paul was engaged in a runaround. I'm quoting from her motion, her order denying that she recused herself for bias. However, by plaintiff's own admission, this lawsuit was filed with the purpose of finding a different judge to look at the issue of restitution which this court addressed in that previous file. She didn't address it in the previous file. It is so extremely frustrating that she can say these things and there's no consequence. And all I'm trying to do is get $21,000 on behalf of my clients through perfectly legitimate reasons. Indeed, Mr. Bradford, my friend, and I like that term, he just admitted that there'd be nothing to stop Morex Properties from pursuing a restitution claim against Alan Max Construction. He's admitting that Morex Properties is entitled to restitution. So for me to not go to the in the underlying action and make a reasoned legal decision to commence a separate one, suddenly that lawsuit becomes in bad faith. I respectfully submit it is not in bad faith. Mr. Bradford admits that my client is entitled to restitution, but just not against Sorrow and Bergstrom and the Warner Law Office. Now, I believe that there's a good faith basis for extending the law because, as everyone here, I think, acknowledges, there has not been decided a case in Minnesota about whether or not you can seek restitution from an attorney. And let me tell you the policy reasons why that might be and should be a viable claim. What if there was $100,000 that's levied from Morex's account instead of $21,000? And Alan Max and Morex and Sorrow and Bergstrom say, hey, run this through your trust. I'm not saying this happened, but run this money through your trust account and take out some for fees. And if there's any left over, funnel it to me. And then we can hide behind a restitution claim that there's not a case in Minnesota that says you can seek restitution against the attorney who gets the money, keeps the money, and deposits it in his or her or its trust account. I believe that Morex Properties is entitled to restitution. I think it's a valid claim to seek it against a law firm. I wish there was something I could do about the misrepresentations that Judge Neal made in numerous orders that were relied upon by the Court of Appeals. But, you know, here we are, and it's just very unfortunate. And again, if Judge Neal isn't objectively biased based upon everything she has written in these orders, many of the things which are not true, then no attorney in the world will ever be able to prove actual bias. Anybody objectively looking at this would say, Judge Neal has something against me, as evidenced by the fact that she sanctioned me and not Morex Properties, for which I am grateful. And of course, I'm keeping Morex Properties apprised of all developments. And my time is again up, unless somebody has a question.
Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe.